Session number 13265, reel number
30. Pull it, mate.
Mr. Marsden, reel 30.
They even think that the war began in December 41 with Pearl Harbor. And when we point out to them that we've been at it since September 1939, the reply is, ah, but what about the Aleutians? Which, of course, leaves us slightly baffled, because it's obvious that they've even got their own piffling bit of history so far thoroughly cocked up. And then the next thing, of course, is, well, you Limeys couldn't build a ship like this. And this is a story which is often told. It has to start somewhere. I'm not suggesting that this is where it started, but it certainly happened to us, you see. What do you mean we couldn't build a ship like this? Well, you know, look at the size of it and so on. This ship has to be American. So we marched them along and showed them the builder's plate, which upset them a bit. But, have I mentioned previous to this business of the meals? I think I had, haven't I? Have we got that far? Well, second day out, I think, still in a fair amount of fog and bad visibility, there's a sudden thump and a red glow in the mist in front of us, and Mary heeled over and turned to port, and the revs went right up and we streaked away, and after some time running more or less north, we turned away eastwards again, and still running at fairly full revs. And the word came down the grapevine from the crew sometime later that a tanker in front of us had been fished. And we thought nothing much more of it. But I read after the war, I read somewhere that this was the one occasion when a U-boat captain thought he had the Mary, and she slipped through a clear patch in the fog, and he angled off waiting for her to come through another clear patch so he could get a bearing on her and get an aim with his torpedoes, and he was all lined up and ready, saw a big ship appearing and let go, and what he did was to get the tanker, get a tanker in front of us, and makes one feel quite happy to think that there's a guardian angel about the place. Anyway, 5, 6, 7 days of this, and we came into Greenock. We lay out in the river, and the American troops were disembarked. And took a fair while. Meanwhile, we had to wait the coming of the customs and excise people. This didn't seem to apply to the American servicemen, but it apparently was certainly going to apply to the returning Brits. However, the Flight Louis I mentioned earlier, the chap whom I first met as a corporal, he took care of these customs and excise bods when they came aboard, because he was the chap who particularly didn't want them to look at the gear he'd got. And we gathered afterwards that he'd passed them the odd bottles of whiskey or bourbon or whatever, and they'd even been imbibing as well, because when it was all over they didn't come anywhere near us, and we simply eventually went ashore with all our kit. As I mentioned earlier, he had 2 or 3 packing cases full of stuff which he'd thieved or liberated from the American forces when he was up in the islands. Outboard motors, complete tool kits, Lord knows what. And so we see the RTO, and we're given travel warrants and sent down to one of those reception centres on the Wirral. I've forgotten the names at the moment. And there we were treated like sprogs. I was a flight sergeant, and myself was a sergeant, Flight Sergeant Tweedy, was it? And myself, and two or three New Zealand and Australian NCO air crew. And there were permanent staff corporals and so on this camp who, by the nature of their position, were quite prepared to push us around and did so. And they were in a position where, if you were at all awkward, they could make life damned uncomfortable for you. Once again, we found that the blankets we were given were filthy, greasy, tacky. It seems to me very likely that there were the usual laundry racket was going on. And
where was this?
There are a couple of transit camps near Liverpool, and RAF transit camps. I'm hanged if at the moment the name's gone out of my head. I can't remember it.
It might come to you later anyway.
Yeah. They were all much of a muchness. The permanent staffs there were real, as the Navy says, real barrack room stanchions, and they were not about to get themselves shifted. They had all the fiddles and everything else all nicely tied up, and they behaved as though they were all warrant officers, regardless. It was no good getting nasty, although we did on occasion bring corporals and LACs up with a bit of a jerk when they got two peas above steaks. It's nothing like making a man stand to attention when he wishes to speak to you to calm him down a little bit, but there's not really much you can do, because the people who handle your postings and possibility of passes and things like that are quite powerful. And it was a miserable 3 or 4 days there. We had the usual medical inspections and things of that order, and checks and kit checks and so on, all done. You know, there's nothing like a rampant store basher who's checking kit and so on, rush of power to the head, to really make people unhappy. And then I got a posting from there to, of all places, Worksop in Nottinghamshire. And this was an OTU with, oddly enough, a flight of Wellingtons and a small section of Hurricanes. A curious mix. And apparently there was a policy to send returning bods from overseas back to stations near their home. Well, whoever had landed me with Worksop, this place, had done me no favours whatever. I would have been far better off posted to some place in Yorkshire. I can remember, though, as we travelled down from Greenock down to Liverpool, being appalled at the what seemed to me to be a huge deterioration in the train services. Everything was so shabby and scruffy and dirty, and suddenly everything seemed tight under the arms, and I was forced back to remembering Kipling's verse and the attitudes of his privates returning from the Boer War and so on. And I suddenly wished that I'd never left New Zealand. a thing which I've wished a good many times since, for that matter.
Do you think it was the contrast with New Zealand, or
it
was a genuine contrast with Britain earlier in the war?
It was a contrast with them all, if you think of it. New Zealand, America, and then coming into Glasgow, and the old railway stuff, the old railway stock, and Liverpool. You know, they'd had a fair old dusting, and it was the people too. We'd been living with people who had had no experience of war in New Zealand. We'd spent a few days in the States, again with people who had absolutely no idea of what the war was like. And we come here now, this is 1944, to folk who had 5 years of it and been under it. You know, in Glasgow and Liverpool, they'd had their basin full. So the attitudes of the people, there was a fair amount of surliness, and people were withdrawn. They didn't want to know. All right, so you're coming back from overseas, so thousands of others, and, you know, there was no feeling of welcome. And what made it worse was the fact that I landed on my birthday. I went ashore on my birthday. So here I am a year older, and here I am back here, and what is it? Yuck.
That's interesting, because people say that the war brought out the best in people.
I think it did when they were dealing with the war and its the immediacy of the war. But quite often when they were dealing with each other and when they were dealing with strangers, they were not always at their best. They were tired. They'd seen it all before. And most of them had seen the elephant. They didn't want to know anyone else's story, or they weren't too good at answering queries. If you were in a strange place and you didn't know where to go and whatever, well, certainly we found it in Glasgow. We tended to get the turned shoulder.
What was the elephant?
Oh. Well, you know, it's an American phrase, isn't it? I think that he'd seen the elephant. In the latter half of the 19th century, possibly a bit earlier too, there were travelling shows in the West with animals. And very often the elephant was a big attraction, and the elephant was not allowed, they didn't parade it. It was hidden, and you paid to see the elephant.
So it means blase.
Yes, yeah. You know, they'd got experience. As the Americans used to say, when a chap came back out of combat, like those Marines that we saw on Vela who'd come back from that faint raid, they'd seen the elephant. We hadn't. We might have seen a different elephant, but we hadn't seen the elephant they'd seen. No, it's not quite the rare e-bird, but of that order. Yeah. And as I say, I found myself, apart from the prospect of going home and seeing my wife again and so on, I really wasn't finding England all that much of a green and pleasant land, after all. Anyway, I can't remember whether I got a 48 or a 72-hour pass before we got our disembarkation leave, and I can't remember how much disembarkation leave I got. It would certainly be at least 14 days, I would think. And I got home, and Margaret, of course, was at work, and I was now living with at Margaret's home, and Margaret's family, and their welcome was, as was fairly typical of Derbyshire and probably Yorkshire folk and whatnot, in those days, shall we say, fairly restrained. You know, the overt show of emotion was not much of a thing in those days. Probably still isn't. Just, I don't know. Margaret came in and didn't come across to me, and you know, we didn't put our arms around each other. She simply sat down in the chair and said hello. And like a clown, the first thing I said was, "Oh, you do sound broad Yorkshire," which didn't go too well. I mean, it went down like a lead balloon, that did, because there was a certain competitiveness between Derbyshire and Yorkshire in those days, as still is in cricket and things of that order. And to be accused of being of sounding Yorkshire wasn't the way to win friends and influence people. Anyway, we settled down. And, I opened up the gear I'd brought home, and everybody was delighted. And that, for that leave period, I don't remember a thing about it, apart from being trailed around to see all the people whom I was supposed to go to see, because it was a done thing, and people asking where you've been and what's it like, and not listening whilst you tell them, which again seems to be a fairly standard kind of thing, because after you've told them where you've been and what you've done and what you've seen, they don't know a darn thing about it. You've met this before, have you?
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, eventually, as I say, I got this posting to the OTU at Worksop, and I detested it. For a start, I'd forgotten most of what I'd ever known about aeroplanes, and I hadn't worked on radial engines since 1939. I knew nothing about Wellingtons, and it was no advantage to me to be posted to that station, because it was a most horror-stricken journey home when I got a 48-hour pass or any time off, because it involved, I think, 3 bus journeys, and under Sod's law, the way things work out, every journey involved a considerable wait for the next bus. So that whilst it's not that many miles from home, as the fly crows, it was the devil of a journey. I could get home, I could have got home from, say, Tangmere about as quickly. Or, you know, any place else that was on anywhere near to a mainline station. So I was absolutely brassed off with it. And in any case, I wanted to carry on working on oxygen plant. So I began a purge. In RAF terms, in those days, a purge was to continually press the orderly room people for a posting, and to put in an application for posting about once a week, until people get so fed up with you that they, if any queries come round, try to post people and so on, then they'll put your name down to get shot of you. Well, as it happens, I did so much bleating about having chosen to come back from the Pacific and New Zealand to try to get in on the invasion, that eventually I got posted to a mobile oxygen unit down in Sussex. It was affiliated to Tangmere, but was in the woods. Oh, hell. forgotten the name of the place. And it was a second TAF unit at Slindon, between Tangmere and Fontwell. We were under the trees there, not far from the main road, the A27. And I received a bit of a shock because the oxygen plant here were quite different from the ones I'd had in the Pacific and the ones I'd trained on, or at least they were different externally. Instead of being Crosley trucks with Brockhaus trailers, these were in AEC six-wheelers, 100 horsepower diesel units. The whole plant was in a single unit, and the output had been doubled simply by running the compressors faster. They were using the same separators, which I was now pleased to discover could handle the increased throughput of air and produce twice as much oxygen. Well, I was I was still carrying my sergeant's tapes, and I was a supernumerary sergeant because the unit was up to strength, but as I found out later, what was happening was that extra bods were being posted onto units in 2nd TAF, so that come the day that they were due to go across, or whenever that was going to be, then regardless of what sickness, illness or whatever might have happened, there would be enough people there to make a full unit. But of course it also meant, on the basis of last in, first out, that if there were no defections in any way and you were still supernumerary, you didn't go. And that was what happened to me. So having gone to the lengths of getting myself posted back from New Zealand so that I could get in on the invasion, which was what it was all about as far as I was concerned, come the time, I believe our lot, the word was in the unit that our crowd was supposed to go forward towards Nijmegen or somewhere of that area. This would be after the initial landing, as a fair piece, of course, when they were getting up there. But it was all part of an organised plan, because the unit would be related to squadrons, and you would wait until the squadrons got to there before it was necessary for the unit to go over and join up with them. All part of the logistics system of supply. I've never bothered to work out what it could have been or how it should have been, but anyway, that was the word. So when the time came for them to be going into concentration to go across, myself and one or two others were scraped off, and I found myself posted to St. Athan. So the whole thing has been a dead loss, as far as I'm concerned. I'm posted to the MU at St. Athan, which is, forget the number of the MU there. Anyway.
This is Merton's unit.
Yeah. And whilst we were at Slindon, found ourselves lying at night under the first doodlebugs, which we found an interesting experience. And we got quite accustomed to hearing the engine stop and waiting for the bump. Fingers crossed, of course, in case we didn't hear the bump, because we were in the wrong place. They were flying over towards Portsmouth and Southampton, I believe. And there seemed to be a fair number of them. We got so used to reacting, in fact, that on one occasion I was going home to Chesterfield on a pass, and I was on St. Pancras Station waiting for the train, and one of these things came over and and cut. And I made a standing jump of about 16 foot and got down flat behind one of those platform seats, concrete framed, and I think concrete bars for the seating and back. And I was behind there like a ferret down a hole, and I could see folks looking at me in amazement, people who hadn't, I guess this might have been early in the doodlebug days, and they weren't clued up as to what was going on. And the one that I had stopped had come down smack into that coal yard outside St Pancras Station. There was a big coal distributing yard there, you know, where coal merchants loaded their wagons up and horses and carts and so on, took them off. And of course the thing went into there, and there was this god awful bump, and the next thing you saw was the most colossal cloud of coal dust scattering everywhere, everyone brushing the stuff off their clothes, stuff filtering down, so the sky was quite hazy for a minute or two. And I stood up, and I wasn't the least bit abashed. I haven't the slightest bother about being slightly frightened under those circumstances. The man who isn't frightened is the man who gets himself dead. Of course, it's only necessary to be frightened enough to move swiftly. You don't have to be frightened and lay there quivering. You just once you've taken cover, that's it. You wait for the outcome. Anyway, St Athan. Oh, that was a gorgeous station. It seemed to be largely populated. There was a hard core of staff there on the technical side who'd been there for the whole of the war. And I found myself attached to the Vickers hydraulic pump repair unit, or whatever you call it, where for the whole of the war an officer who was now a flight lieutenant and a flight sergeant, I don't know what he was when he started out, but he was now a flight sergeant, those two had run that section for I gather pretty well all the war, and they were convinced that the successful prosecution of the war depended entirely upon that workshop at St Athan. And they developed the usual English-type myths or ethos or whatever you like to call it in connection with the place. Everyone who was attached to it was supposed to go down onto the shop floor and do a full service on a Vickers hydraulic pump and have it pass through the test first go. That was the idea. And I said, well, what's that got to do with me? Ah, well, we've all done it. I said, so? I said, all you're doing is lapping. It's a straightforward lapping job. The whole essence of of this thing was that the Vickers hydraulic pump is a cylindrical core with a bore in it, a couple of 3 inches in diameter, and the core is, I guess, something of the order of an inch and a half thick, with a faceplate either side.